Welcome to the 19th episode of season 4 of the Canonical UK podcast. It's Tuesday the 8th of November 2011, and in this episode we're going to have another quiz.
Yay!
And we'll talk to James Smith of AMI, and we'll of course go over the latest news, events, bit about Ubuntu, command line love, and your feedback. I'm Alan, and with me this week is Laura.
It's
only called you Loney then. Laura.
Her name is Laura.
Hello.
Tony.
Hi.
And Mark.
Hello.
So, Mark, what have you been up to?
I've been playing with Ruby, writing fun scripts with XVFB, which is a virtual X server that lets you run like graphical applications on a headless server, which is fun.
Why would you do that?
Basically, I wanted to write a script which screen scraped some websites, which needed me to log in first, and there's a tool you can use in Ruby which basically lets you remote control a browser, but you need a browser running to do that.
Could you not use something like Beautiful Soup or something that doesn't need a GUI?
I could do, but that's for Python.
Okay.
And
is right.
It's probably easier.
He doesn't like Python, does our Mark? And was it successful?
Yes. Surprisingly, it sort of all just worked. I mean, it took a bit of hacking to make sure I had everything installed that I needed before my script would run. But once I had everything installed, I just ran it, and all of a sudden, I got all the stuff I wanted.
Yay!
Yes.
Laura, what have you been up to?
Hello. I upgraded the RAM on my laptop and netbook.
Yeah.
It's going to be one of those shows, isn't it?
Yeah. So now my netbook's running at a speedy 1.5 gigabytes.
That was quite an engineering task, wasn't it?
It was. Everything came out. Absolutely every bit of the motherboard, pretty much.
Oh, my.
So, and it worked first time.
Hooray.
And and I got a new phone.
Is it an Android phone?
It is, and it's aubergine purple.
So you've gone from, what was it, Symbian, you had a phone?
Yeah.
You've finally gone for Android.
Yeah.
And what type of phone is it?
It's HTC Rhyme.
Is that good?
Yes. It's the same as the Desire S.
I don't know one Android phone from another one. I'm only allowed one phone. Steve Jobs gave me an iPhone and that was it. Any choice.
Yeah, it's like a Desire S, but purple.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
You like it?
Yeah, it's great.
Cool. Tony.
Hello.
What have you been doing?
We went to a murder mystery party at the weekend.
Oh, yes.
Were you murdered?
No, and I wasn't the murderer either. We were dressed as Victorians.
Yes.
Which is really weird because it was set in the 1960s.
It set at a murder mystery party in the 1960s?
Yes. But that was good fun. And that was Amy Ferguson had organised that with her husband, Neil. So she invited us to that.
I've just observed the,
Quick
getting
check.
Amy mentioned in this show again.
Yes, we hired costumes from a local theatre.
I saw the photo.
And I took a photo on my new phone, which allowed me to do a sepia effect.
Unfortunately, I already have large sideburns, so they fitted in
quite well. Yes, really good, actually.
You do look good in very old clothes.
Yes, I like these ones I'm wearing now. Maybe I should get the top hat, wear it for the show. Mm. What about you, Alan? Any news?
I went to UDS last week.
And why was that?
It was a bit of a surprise because I wasn't going to go. I haven't applied for sponsorship or anything. And then,
no, you're slacking, really, aren't you?
Yeah, I know. And then some nice person at Canonical offered me a job.
Excellent.
So I am now working for Canonical.
Congratulations.
Mm. Thanks very much.
The rot has officially set in. What do you do?
How long have we got left as a podcast now?
My job title is engineering manager. I manage a team of...
What are you managing the engineering of?
Stuff to do with Ubuntu.
Oh, wow.
Exciting new stuff to do with Ubuntu.
Cool. He could tell you, but then he would have to kill you.
Unfortunately, I can't tell you all of it.
He hasn't got the time.
Yeah, I've got to leave now. I'm far too busy. everyone else who works for Canonical, I have to go now.
Yes, well, there we go.
But as part of the community, you have to keep your community...
Absolutely.
Going.
Absolutely. No, and just to clarify, because a lot of people have asked me this, that I stepped down from some community leadership positions. So the sequence of events was I stepped down, then I got offered a job.
Yes.
Lots of people think I got offered a job and then went, hooray, and stepped down from all the community.
Now I don't have to do this free stuff anymore.
Yeah, screw you lot. Bye.
And you want to fill in that survey again now?
Yeah. Yes.
And you have to leave the not canonical launchpad group.
I did. I left that and a couple of people were a little bit surprised.
I think I joined it just to make up the numbers.
Oh, good man.
Just to compensate for you leaving.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, congratulations. Thank and I'm you. Sure we'll find out more about that in due course.
Let's hope so. You and me both.
Yeah, if they haven't got you sweeping the offices.
I'll make you a good cup of tea.
Okay, well, that's good. Right, let's get on with the show.
And now it's time for the triumphant return of the UUPC quiz.
Hooray!
Yay.
Hooray.
Did anyone hear that? Because I didn't. Oh, there we go.
Yay.
We have a slight delay.
Right. So I'm in the hot seat as quizmaster this week. And today's quiz will be based loosely on a popular daytime quiz show on BBC, but slightly different for legal reasons. Which you might know is pointless, but we're going to call no points.
That's me.
It's the open source way to go and give it a completely different name, isn't it?
Shouldn't it be an anagram?
Yes. Moving
on. Yes, for bonus points, you can come up with an anagram. Okay. Right, so the idea of this game is that before the show, we surveyed 50 people. We asked them a series of questions. They had to name items within a category. It's a bit like the show we did last time. Except this time, instead of trying to find the answer they gave, which the most people gave, you have to find the answer they gave, well, the answer which the least or no people gave, but it still has to be correct.
Wow. This is complicated.
So rather than trying to get as many points, the winner is going to be the person with the least points.
Laura might be in for the chance of
Yay!
This.
So yeah. For the first round, okay. For the first round, you'll each pick a category and then everyone will give an answer. And then whoever has the least points at the end of the round goes through to the head-to-head.
Ooh.
So, which I'll explain when we get there.
So just for example, you will say list category of something.
Yes.
Particular. For example, I don't know what they are. So some piece of software.
Yes.
And we will all go around and guess things that we think are on the list.
Yes.
But they're as low as possible.
Yes.
Without not being on the list
yes.
at all.
So if it's not on the list at all, it doesn't count.
If it's correct, then you get no points, which is the best thing you can do. If it's incorrect, you get 50 points, which is the worst you can do.
Okay. You've got all the right answers
so if
on your list.
I have a list of all of the right answers.
Okay.
So the answer you give has to be on there. If people gave that answer, you get as many points as people who gave the answer.
Which is bad.
Unless right. no one gave the answer, in which case it's good. You'll get it. You'll pick it up as
okay,
we go along.
Okay, we've got about 12 and a half
Hang on. If
left.
Nobody gives the answer, if we pick an answer that isn't on your list, we still get points?
No.
No, we get none.
Right.
Yeah, nobody gets any.
That's what I thought. I've got this now.
And no arguments. Whatever my list is correct.
And you're saying they've made a TV program out of this?
I've never heard of it.
Oh, it's daytime.
Good, yeah. Right.
It's
okay,
more complex
so...
than supermarket sweep, isn't it?
Alan is on my left, so he gets the first pick. The categories you can choose from are applications, Linux, or processors.
I'm going to go with applications.
Applications. Okay. We asked 50 people to name as many KDE applications as they could think of. And just to qualify, we're looking for individual applications that are officially part of the KDE software collection, having a page on KDE.org.
Okay. So I have to name an application.
Yes.
That ideally is in your list that nobody has
yes.
chosen. Right, okay. K-Vivio or Vivo or whatever it is, the Vizio version thing.
It's K-Vivio, is that your answer?
I think it's K-Vivio, yeah.
No, I'm afraid...
Oh, hang on, is that good or bad?
I don't know.
That means that you're wrong and it's not on the list.
So I get 50 points?
You get 50 points.
Yay! Oh, no, that's bad, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh.
So Tony,
right?
Same
yes.
question.
Still confused.
KDE application,
yes.
That
oh.
is on the list, but is a little Kate.
Sorry,
this is the only KDE application I think I know.
Kate, the popular text editor.
Yes,
it says popular.
Hey, okay,
and that scores 16 points.
Okay,
better
Laura,
than 50.
Better than
oh,
me,
God.
Yeah. Come on, Laura.
Oh.
Name a KDE app. Just make a word up and put K,
K in the front.
It's a fair point.
I know one, but it's going to get like 49 points. So.
Still better than 50.
Conqueror.
Ooh.
Good one.
Yeah. That is a KDE app.
Yeah.
Yay!
Yes, and that scores 17 points.
Ooh.
Close.
Are we still going?
Now we're on to the second question. Tony, you're next, and the category choices are Linux or processors.
I think we're going to have to do all of them.
Processors.
Right. We asked 50 people to name as many processor architectures that are supported by Debian GNU Linux as possible. So this is stable supported architectures that are as listed on Debian.org.
I'm going with MIPS.
Oh, we're going to go with that.
Sorry, just trying not to break my spreadsheet. MIPS.
Yep. Great.
And that was 7 points, so a low scoring one there.
Yeah.
So, Laura, you're next.
Spark.
That is a processor architecture.
I know.
Look at you. Can Tony get extra points for being patronised? Well done, you.
Yay!
Yes, that was a slightly higher scoring one, getting you 20 points, unfortunately.
Oh, that was really good.
Alan?
IA64.
That could be a good one.
If it's up there, I'll give you the money myself.
Yes.
And that scored you 10 points.
Ooh, not bad.
Not bad.
How does he get more less points for that?
The Spark's quite popular, I think.
Don't forget, he got 60 points.
He said IA64, not I386 or AMD64.
AMD64 was quite high scoring in that round. Mm. Okay, and the last question in this round, Laura, you get to start. And the last remaining topic is Linux.
That's a nice narrow one.
And the question is, we asked 50 people to name as many Linux contributors as they could think of. And this is contributors to the official repository appearing in the credits file of the official GitHub repository.
For Linux.
The Linux kernel itself.
Okay.
Matthew Garrett.
Nice.
Good one.
He is an actual Linux contributor.
Has he actually contributed to
Durant's kernel?
The kernel is...
Oh.
No, he's not on my list, unfortunately. That gets you 50
points. It could
points.
Be true, but it's not on the list.
Oh, dearie me.
I based this on the actual file today.
Oh,
so,
fair enough.
Unless the file's wrong.
Or he goes under a different name.
Or he goes under a different name, in which case, that's his fault.
Do a quick search for MJG. Does it find it?
You can't ask him the answer before you answer the question.
No, this is yours.
Oh,
Matthew
right.
Garrett is MJG. If
that's there, then I'll give it to you.
I'm being nice. Uh-huh. Give me a second chance.
Sorry, this is quite unwieldy. MJG.
There's Dennis, doesn't
it? No.
Okay. Ha! Okay. So someone who's contributed something to the Linux kernel.
Ever.
Not just the current version. Ever.
I think it's got a bit of...
Well, he or she has to be credited in the official GitHub repository.
Well, there's the obvious.
Yes.
How many people did you ask?
50.
Ben Collins.
Oh, I think that's quite a good answer. Particularly if there are Ubuntu.
Could be Benjamin
fans.
Collins, couldn't it?
It could be. This is slick.
No.
Oh,
what?
Sorry.
I'm guessing it's not just a control F on a web page you're looking at.
Hold on. I am about
he
to.
Is now.
I am about to do a control F on a web page just to check my answers.
But surely it doesn't matter if they're in the file if people need to have said the answer as well.
Yes. No.
If they're in the file. It's good. You don't have to have said that.
Clear as mud. Yeah. Clear as mud.
Okay.
So I didn't get any. I got 50 more
no,
points.
Collins, no, it doesn't appear in the file.
Okay.
50
points. Sorry. Yes, so 50 points for Alan as well. And Tony?
My answer is Greg Crower Hartman.
Greg Crower Hartman.
Loony.
Sorry?
Don't ask me how to spell Crow.
Don't worry, I am very practiced in the spelling of Crow Hartman by now.
Is that all the hate mail you sent?
No, it was spending hours collating this today. Oh, the effort I went to, you have no idea.
Well, we saw some of it.
Yes, and that scores you a low, low score of 12 points.
Get in.
And at the end of that round, the scores on the doors are Alan with 110 points, Tony with 35 points, and Laura with 87 points.
Yes! So I'm afraid, not last!
Alan, you get knocked out at this stage. Thanks for playing.
I'll go home.
Bye, Alan.
Thanks.
But Tony and Laura go through to
head-to-head.
Head-to-head.
Is there a special tension music at this point?
No. Right, so the game...
It would be, except it didn't make any.
Yeah, basically. So the game changed a little at this point. You both give me the answer to the question before we find out what the scores are, and whoever scores lowest gets a point, and it's first to 2 points.
First to two. Okay.
So best of three.
We just have to answer questions, basically.
Yeah, just answer the questions. Let him spreadsheet do it.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've gone home.
So, Laura, you're behind, so you get the first choice of category, and the categories are television, Ubuntu, or religion?
Television.
Okay. We asked 50 people to name actors who have played the Doctor on screen. In Doctor Who, of course. And we're looking specifically for actors who have played the Doctor in the official television continuity.
And it's going to be the one the least likely to have picked.
Yes.
Patrick Troughton.
Okay, and Tony?
William Hartnell.
And Laura is the winner there. I'll just make a noise.
I thought you'd win that
She
one.
Got 10 points against Tony's 12.
Oh, not far out. All right, so okay. You're one up then, Laura.
So, Tony, next category, you have either Ubuntu or religion.
Let's go with religion.
Okay, we asked 50 people to name popes of the 20th century.
Oh, no!
So these are people who have held the office of Pope between the 1st of 1st, 1900 and the 31st of the 12th, 1999, according to the Vatican website.
I will go with John Paul I. I assume there was one.
First. Okay, and Laura?
John Paul II.
There was definitely one of those. I never thought I'd be talking about popes other than Alan on this show.
Thank you.
And Tony wins that round with 10 Ooh. To 28.
Wow.
One
he didn't so, know he was so popular.
So that's...
Me or the Pope.
That's one all. And the final topic is Ubuntu.
It's all come down to this.
So we asked 50 people to name Ubuntu release code names. So here we're looking for the full name of released Ubuntu versions in adjective animal format, not version numbers. So, Laura,
what your people are first, least please. Likely to remember?
Breezy Badger.
Breezy Badger, an early version, a good guess there. And Tony?
Edgy F.
Oh, I would have gone with that as well.
You can't see the smug look on his face. Oh,
well, if Alan said he's going to go for Laura, it, it's a good one.
Breezy Badger scores 24 points. Tony, okay. Edgy Eft, scores 20 points.
Oh,
you're the winner of this week's Ubuntu UK podcast
I
quiz.
I win again.
But I'm not last.
That's true.
Equally worth celebrating.
Yes.
That's good, is it? Oh, man.
So, well done, guys.
Well done, Tony.
Thank you, listeners, for listening in. And we'll see you next time on the Ubuntu UK podcast quiz.
And now it's time for some news. ALAC, the Apple Lossless Audio Codec, has been made available under the Apache license. The released code includes the encoder and decoder, as well as an example command line utility for converting files to the ALAC format.
Why do they bother? Is it better than FLAC?
I don't know.
Well, there are certain hardware devices made by Apple that don't support FLAC, that only support ALAC. So if you happen to have an Ubuntu desktop and you've got a something like Rhythmbox or Banshee and you want to put your music onto your Apple-based device, then if this is supported in your player, then, like, then you'd be able to do that.
iPods and stuff support ALAC, but they don't support FLAC.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And FLAC is GPL, and this is Apache, which means proprietary software. People can include it without having to release modifications, which is going to make it more attractive to them.
Mm. Okay. I thought it was a new format and didn't see the point, but okay.
But now you do.
HP has announced that it will be producing ProLiant servers running on ARM processors. The new generation of servers could provide substantial power and space savings over their current x86-based counterparts, and the first models are expected to become available in the first half of next year.
Yeah, so you can get super high densities of cores in a small amount of space, consuming a low amount of power. These look really cool.
16 servers in 1U, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
really cool, as in low temperature.
In lots of ways, yeah. The announcement, they streamed it live in the conference room at UDS, and there were lots of people there all watching with excitement, because as part of the announcement, Red Hat and Canonical were, I think, announced as partners to this, providing software and support for...
So we're going to be able to get Red Hat and Ubuntu on low-power ARM servers.
I don't think Red Hat do ARM, do they? At the moment. Well, so they might do in the future. I know Canonical do.
You have to hope, otherwise it's not much use them being partners.
Speaking of which, Canonical and Red Hat have published a joint white paper on the impacts of the secure boot proposals to Linux. The paper discusses the merits and disadvantages of secure boot for both users and software vendors, and goes on to recommend that user remains able to configure secure boot as required. It's pretty good, cool. Nice collaboration between Canonical and Red Hat produce a document that clearly outlines the position that many Linux vendors are hoping OEMs and manufacturers will take.
Yes.
Yeah, and hopefully it'll enable us to boot Linux on these bits.
Well, I mean, there is some people who say, oh, this is rubbish, you shouldn't have secure boot, it should be disabled and the user should be able to disable it. But really, if you tell someone, here, put this Linux CD in your computer, and, oh, by the way, turn off this security feature before you do it, it kind of doesn't sound right. So
either way, it's an extra hoop to jump through, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly.
And we don't need that. The Cabinet Office has published an open source procurement toolkit, a set of documents designed to dispel myths around open source and ensure that a level playing field is created for open source software in government. The documents include open source FAQs and examples of open source software that may be considered in place of proprietary solutions.
And Alan's read this.
I've read a few of them. I'll flick through them. And they're really cool.
Yeah, I'm getting quite excited.
Yeah. They're actually coherent, sensible, you know, advice on how to deal with open source and busting some myths as well, which is good.
What sorts of things can you remember offhand?
Like myths that you can't cost an open source solution. And it's got a nice big table of open source products and their proprietary equivalents and how they might be used, like examples of how they could be used. Loads of examples, in fact. So, more than the usual, you know, Firefox is like Internet Explorer, OpenOffice is like Microsoft Office.
Yeah.
There's like a massive table of like real world examples of Office and other enterprise apps that people might be interested in. Yeah, it's really good.
Excellent.
It's good to see.
Putting past differences aside, Microsoft has contributed a patch to Samba. The code is licensed under GPL3 and adds some improvements to NTLM authentication for Firefox and Samba.
Good. Which is cool.
Yeah. Because at the moment, IE does NTLM authentication, but Firefox doesn't.
I think it does.
It does.
You
but
get a
this
pop-up
is,
box.
So
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, you get a pop-up box. That's it. It's not transparent.
Right.
Kind of pass-through.
So if you're in a corporate network where the proxy server is an NTLM authenticating proxy, IE will silently pass your credentials to the proxy server and let you out, but Firefox will pop up a dialogue asking you for your Windows logon and password then give that to the proxy server, which is horrible. If you're logging onto like a remote site, you first of all get the credentials for the proxy and then you get the credentials logon for your remote site. So it's quite nice that that's all.
Yeah. Or
and it's Microsoft.
Yeah. It's really good to see.
Yeah.
Or an IIS web server that's authenticating you as a user.
Ah, it fixes that as well.
In a domain. Well, that's NTLM authentication as well.
Cool.
That's good.
And now it's time for some events. And the Bitcoin conference is happening in Prague on the 25th to the 27th of November. Find out more at conference.bitgroups.org.
Yes. Go along and make some money out of thin air. That's my understanding of how Bitcoin works.
Right. Excellent. Excellent.
It's you're going to get the Linux Action Show guys on your back now.
Yeah, because you don't understand the American fiscal system.
Neither do the Americans, by the sound of it. Hey!
And there's Indiana Linux Fest, April 13th to 15th. So a bit of notice next year, and that's in Indiana in America.
Indiana in America. Cool. And is FOSDEM happening, Alan?
Yeah, I think it's still happening in February next year.
Good, good.
So now it's time for some command line love, and we got our command line love this week from Russell Dickinson via email, because he said he recently needed to rotate a video by 90 degrees because of the way it had been recorded, which is something I've had to do before. After quite some searching, he found a solution on Stack Overflow using FFmpeg, and we'll stick it in the show notes. But there's a transpose function on it, and it's one of FFmpeg's many video filters, which according to the man page is used to transpose rows with columns in the input video and optionally flip it.
Yes,
flip it. Well, this is useful if you've recorded it something on an iPhone or an Android phone or whatever, and you've held it vertically, and then you get home and you want to play it on your widescreen.
Well, I don't find that happens because the phone
senses how you're holding it up, but you might have a handy cam where you've held it sideways or something.
Yeah.
Or a rubbish phone. Yeah.
My digital camera was a problem doing that because I put them all portrait and then didn't realise that I couldn't just rotate them.
Yeah, so maybe smartphones do it better than cameras.
It's really easy to rotate photos, you know, in most software you can rotate, but videos are a little bit harder.
Yeah.
I think when I did it, I had to separate it out into JPEGs, rotate them and back again.
That's going to be lossy, isn't it?
It
wasn't great.
Cool. Anyway, well, thank you very much indeed for sending that in, Russell Dickinson. I kept thinking it was David Dickinson, but it's not. But I suppose that suggestion was cheap as chips. Thank you.
Tumbleweed.
Right, let's get on with it. So we've got the interview with James Smith now that we recorded at Home Camp. So Laura, give us a kind of 30-second overview of what Home Camp is.
So it was a 2-day unconference in London a couple of weeks ago, and it's a community of home energy and hardware hacking enthusiasts. So the theme of the conference was Hack the House. So it's sort of home automation, energy monitoring things, and behaviour change, and I presented at it.
Yes, you did. You gave a very good presentation.
Thank you.
And James was there as well, and they were the sponsors of the conference.
They were, Amy.
Yeah, and we chatted to him about what they get up to. Laura and I are here at Home Camp with James Smith from AIMEE. So tell us a bit about AIMEE.
Okay, AIMEE is a platform for greenhouse gas calculation. So we're a web service that provides an easy-to-use API for developers to do carbon calculation, all that kind of thing, energy management and so on. A lot of people think it's kind of A times B, you know, the amount of carbon per mile times the number of miles. That's sometimes the case, but a lot of them are much, much more complicated. So we have, you know, 100-line algorithms in some of the categories and things. So there's a lot in there.
You had an example in the talk you gave this morning about a cow. How is a cow so complicated?
Oh, cows are very complicated. They produce all sorts of different things, for a start. In the presentation this morning, I was using the example of, say, you're a farmer. You need to work out the emissions from your cows. Your cows produce gas from what's called enteric fermentation, which is a slightly nicer way of saying burping and farting. And then dealing with manure and things like that. So it all goes into, you know, into there are different calculation methodologies for each of those different stages.
What do you do with this data when you've worked out how much your cow produces?
So, I mean, we provide the data and the calculation. So it's really down to whoever's building their application on top of our platform. So in the case of a lot of people here at Home Camp, they're dealing with energy. So they'll be using electricity factors, you know, from different countries, different times of the day. Even we have real-time electricity factors, for instance. But if it's somebody else, they'll be using travel, or if it's our hypothetical web-enabled farmer, he'll be tracking the emissions from his cows online. So it's all about basically making things measurable. So if you want to improve something, the first thing you really need to do is measure it and know what you need to improve, and that's kind of core to what Amy's there for, is meaning that all this stuff is measurable.
Where is it that you get the data from, the calculations?
So it's all... We basically republish things from standards bodies, from scientific literature, so on and so forth. There are a lot of things come from groups like the IPCC, the EPA in the US, DEFRA, or DEC, sorry, here in the UK. And, you know, many more. There are many methodologies that have come from universities and so on and so forth. So most of that is already out there, but they publish it in PDFs and in spreadsheets and things like that, which, you know, coders don't really like. So they're very difficult to use. So we stick it in an nice, easy-to-use API.
The government has committed to making data available in proper formats. Have you started to see that come through yet, or is that still a little way off?
Interestingly, we were kind of in there before the government was even thinking about open data. 4 years ago, when they launched their Act on CO2 carbon calculator, Amy was the engine behind that. And our founder, Gavin Starks, had written a white paper for DEFRA at the time about making data reusable and open and available and so on. And Amy was, in a way, kind of one of the first instances of that. You know, we've got all the information from that, and from that initial calculator for like 1.5 million homes across the UK. And so it's sort of an early entrant into the open data, open government data area there.
So when you get data published, do you find problems with it ever?
Surprisingly often, yes. you tend to find when these sort of standards bodies have put their things together, they've written it all down, and there are occasional typos and things like that, and occasionally you get a mega instead of a kilo, and it's, you know, just little things like that. So because we're often the only ones who've really gone to the trouble of codifying it, we find these issues, and then they call us the next time and say, can you check it first before we publish it? So it's very good, yes.
So you had a positive response from the people whose data you've been sourcing and republishing?
Yeah, absolutely. We're sort of making it all more accessible for them. So
Nobody's been, ooh, aren't you doing that?
Not that I know of.
And the geeky part of this, it comes in with some of the back-end stuff that you do. It's not just about a website with a load of data on it.
Yeah. So we have a back-end platform, which is all on... actually, a lot of it's on Ubuntu boxes.
Yeah.
Which is nice. the stuff we're using these days is Ubuntu. The old ones are Red Hat. But it's...
it's always progress.
Yeah, so we have... Yeah, exactly. But yeah, we're built on, you know, open source and things like that, and from the ground up, really. We're a very open company. We believe in all that kind of thing. So a lot of everything really we publish is a lot of the tools we publish around the API are all open source. So people can download SDKs for various different languages. They're all open source. Do what you like. Time licenses, and we build more and more complex frameworks for our own internal use, and they're also published open source. So basically the theory is, if it's not our absolute core business, and our core business is providing access to that data, then, to be honest, we want to make it as easy as possible for people to do that. So publishing things openly just works really well for that.
So what programming languages do you provide tools for?
We have tools available for Java, PHP. We have some code available for C#, which was only sort of starting to become available because there's not been much call for it, really. But the kind of weapon of choice in-house is Ruby these days. That's probably our most complete, and we've built our application framework, what we call our app kit, on top of the Rails framework. So, you know, if you've generated a Rails app, you can then in about, you know, 10 more lines of code have it doing calculations through Amy, which is makes application development really very quick, and that's all, you know.
So are you looking to see independent application developers incorporate Amy stuff into their apps? Have you seen that happening?
Absolutely.
What sort of
stuff? Absolutely, yeah. That's what we do. We build our own apps sometimes when we have to, but we're an API company. So we provide the platform, we provide the data for other applications. So as I was saying, the initial project, the Act on CO2 one, was a front end built by a different agency with our stuff in the back end. There have been many, many more like that. Lots of major, you know, large companies using it. We've done lots of different things, and a few more frivolous ones as well, but they're always fun.
That's good. What's your favourite?
Currently at the moment, my favourite is the Minecraft hack, but that's partly because I did it last weekend and haven't got bored of it yet.
Explain to us what that is.
Yes, I went to a hackathon in Stockholm last weekend and wasn't quite sure what to do, and decided I'd been playing lots of Minecraft. Thought, hey, I know, you can get the code for this. We'll have a look and we'll stick some carbon emissions into it. So basically every time you set fire to a bit of wood or burn a bit of coal in a furnace or whatever, it emits the correct amount of carbon into the atmosphere. So it uses AMI, it uses the proper scientific data from the IPCC to actually do it really right, rather than just shoving in some random numbers. And, you know, it has some fun things in it, like when you pollute too much, the clouds turn black and whatever. So you have to kind of clean up after yourself by growing more trees and things like that, because they pull it back out. So that's good.
And be honest, you set a fire to pigs, don't you?
You can, yes. Yes, quite a lot. It's one of the more fun things to test.
And there's
we don't actually have actual information for setting fire to live pigs in AMI, but you know there are municipal waste combustion categories, so you can pretend that pigs are made of food waste.
And, it is now.
Yeah, it is. It is now. That's it. So,
the carbon itself, the total, is displayed in the upper left-hand corner of the.
Yeah, displays a total as you emit more and more, that counts up in the corner, and as I say, it has impacts on the environment around you. It's people sort of keep asking for things like, oh great, could you make it raise the sea level and things like that. I'm thinking that would be great, and I bet it's really hard, but you know, you never know, more to come.
What about integration with other games? Could you see that sort of thing maybe in a more realistic first person shooter or something?
Definitely. I'm not sure exactly how, certainly in first person shooters, but I'm sure there are things that can be done there. I think, you know, making things, getting these concepts into places where people aren't necessarily looking for them is a way of getting them in front of people, and getting just that thin end of the wedge in to start that process of behaviour change, I think, is really important. I mean, a lot of people are looking at kind of gamification of these complex ideas, and exactly how to go about it is going to be interesting to find out. One of the other guys in AMI suggested doing the same thing for Angry Birds the other day. So you have to do it in a minimum number of carbon-emitting birds. I'm not entirely sure how I'd do that, but you know, there are some possibilities.
You could do it in the Sims or Theme Hospital, one of those management type games.
Theme Hospital, yeah. I love that game. That was amazing.
So, have you got? Obviously, there's a company at the core of AMI, but have you got a community of developers and things growing around you?
We have a sort of growing developer community. Hopefully organising our own hack event in January. That should be coming up, hopefully. We're starting a couple of meetup groups kind of around London, so we're London-based at the moment, just around people working in this sort of clean web area. You know, it's quite strange. It's a bit of a gap. You know, we're in an industry where we're aimed at developers with an interest and knowledge of sustainability. And there are a lot of people out there who are developers, and there are a lot of people out there who are sustainability experts, and there aren't that many in the middle. Mm-hmm. And so kind of bringing that together, but you see at events like this, and even at other hack days and things like that, there are a lot of people who are actually doing that kind of thing, who have an interest. You know, you go along to some of the Rewired State hack days, for instance, and there are people there in hack days that aren't environment-focused at all who are coming up with environmentally themed hacks. So there is an interest there, and it is growing, I think. And yeah, we're you know, hoping to bring that community together.
And maybe if you get people from both sides, you can get them talking and coming up with the ideas together.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, that's the thing we want to do at this upcoming hack, actually, is get developers who don't know really what the sustainability issues are, and sustainability people who don't know how to make anything, and get them together and talking. Yeah. Because the things you do see people developing are very good, but they're often kind of, you know, iterations of similar concepts. You get a lot of people sort of developing different types of energy, electricity graph, for instance, which is great. But there are some really quite complex problems out there, things like life cycle analysis. How do you actually work out how much carbon has been produced in the, you know, in this table or something like that? So there are some really difficult problems, and actually if you can introduce good developers to the people who know what those are and how maybe you could go about approaching them, there'd be some really fruitful results, hopefully. So
what else is in the future for AIME? New developments, new types of data to go in, perhaps?
Oh, always more data. There's huge amounts of data out there. We have a science team whose entire job is just to find more data and bring it in and keep it up to date. So, we sort of trawl the web regularly and have little robots that go out there and keep everything up to date. And more and more of that, more open source, more things into the application, into the app kit that we've been developing. I showed this morning we were making an app in 5 minutes or whatever, but then to take that to the next level, to be able to make sort of fully featured apps that can do all manner of complex things just by shoving together some standard components, that's something we really want to do. But just more and more people developing in this area, solving the really hard problems that we need to solve as a species.
And you talked a bit earlier about getting access to data from the government here in the UK, but you track stuff globally as well, so there's data for America and everywhere. Is it easy, more difficult to get the data out of those other countries and governments?
It's really, really variable. If you take something like the electricity factors, for instance, so DEC publish a standardised year-on-year electricity factor each year. I think it's normally for the previous year, so it's about up to a year behind. We do also have sort of a real-time feed, so actually the National Grid publishes data very regularly. But if you go to the US and you look at what's the emission of that grid there, the last data for that was published in 2007. So the how up-to-date the data is, how detailed the data is, and whether people are willing to part with that data is very, very variable across the world. It's a challenge.
It's just a case of asking and seeing if they've got it.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes just sort of doing it anyway, if it's available.
Do you charge for all the APIs that you have, or do you segment them?
In terms of charging, there's basically a charge for using the API. So just a service charge for a number of transactions. We have some sort of open source plans, particularly. So open source developers get an open source plan, which doesn't cost anything, which is good. We want to sort of stimulate all that kind of thing. We do have some data sets within the API that we have licensed from other companies. So there are some that are proprietary, which we then have to sub-license. Obviously, we'd like to just make them available to everybody, but they want their money. So you can normally start with a lot of public data. Most of it's public. And then if you do need one of these particular sets, then you can kind of upgrade to that. But
cool. So where can people find out more?
They can find out more at aime.com. That's AMEE. That's the best place to start. It has all our stuff. There's a big search engine for all of the data that's in the platform at discover.aime.com, which includes things like you can go and actually do any calculation you like, and it'll generate code for you even. So you can actually go and find a calculation, click generate code, paste it into a script, and you're done.
Including the cows.
You could recreate the calculator.
Yeah, I did like that on your demonstration. Calculate.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much.
We're good at puns as well.
Thanks very much indeed for talking to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers. And now it's time for a bit about Ubuntu.
Gerald.
And... Ooh. We're going to have a bit of a special bit about Ubuntu this time because Alan has been to UDS in America.
Yes.
And so there were some big announcements, I believe, which he's going to tell us about.
Yeah. Well, the first one was Mark blogged about new stuff in the Ubuntu world.
This is Mark Shuttleworth?
Yes. Not specifically, me. He introduced it with... the phrase, by 1404 LTS, Ubuntu will power tablets, phones, TVs, and smart screens from the car to the office, kitchen, and it will connect those devices cleanly and seamlessly to the desktop, the server, and the cloud.
Wow.
So that's interesting. Food for thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
Something to look forward to in a couple of years.
Spreading the Ubuntu love.
All over the house.
So 2014 LTS will be not
the coming LTS, but the one after it.
Yes,
presumably.
Every 2 years we do an LTS.
Yeah.
And now LTSs are supported for 5 years, so they'll overlap a bit. So the next one after this one. So we're talking 2 years away. There's this aspiration to do stuff with phones and tellies and tablets and fridges and everything.
Ubuntu.
Yeah. Ooh, yes. And he talks about Unity as well, I think, talking about Unity. And so that word Unity, when you think about Unity, not unifying like desktops, but unifying devices, it kind of makes more sense.
Mm.
Yeah, you see?
So you'd have the same interface on your TV as you have on your laptop, as you have on your tablet, as you have on your phone.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Interesting.
It'd be fun, though, if you start to think about things like Unity, like Ubuntu One, you know, making the same sort of services or files or data or whatever available across all these different platforms and devices, it would be really nice.
Yeah. And even like synchronizing stuff across, like, you know, maybe if you're, I don't know, using a document on one device, viewing a document on one device, and you make changes, and then instantly those changes ripple through to all your other devices. You know,
your
like,
fridge.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to edit documents on my fridge. Totally.
Shopping
a new
list.
Fridge, yeah.
So there are a load of sessions at UDS, and I picked out a few that I was in, and a few that people have been talking about. Probably the one that most people have been talking about is the whole Ubuntu are going to throw away Banshee and go back to Rhythmbox. That's been like talked about a lot.
Oh, I'm glad I didn't switch.
Well, actually, it's not necessarily true. It was talked about in a session. It was brought up. In a session that was about what apps should we have by default in Ubuntu. And I don't think it was actually planned to be talked about, but it ended up being talked about, and the people in the room thought, yeah, it might be a good idea to switch back to Rhythmbox for the LTS. But as with all of the stuff that's done at UDS, that's not a final decision, and it will play out over the next 6 months. So it's not like we're instantly throwing away Banshee and we're going to use Rhythmbox. It's not final at all.
What would be the alternative to Tomboy?
Well, again, there isn't necessarily an idea to throw Tomboy away. I think what was suggested was, well, if we got rid of Banshee, then there's nothing else that's really compelling that uses mono on the CD.
Yeah. Right.
So let's get rid of all the other stuff. And the only other two things that use mono on the CD is Tomboy and G-Brainy. So then the theory is, well, if you get rid of Banshee, Tomboy, and G-Brainy, you can get rid of mono and you can save some place on the install CD.
Mm.
That's the theory.
And a lot of angst.
Yeah, and get a lot of grumpiness in as a bonus. But again, it's not decided. It's kind of up in the air at the moment. And there's been a great discussion started. I'll put a link in the show notes on the Ubuntu desktop mailing list where people are discussing this now and bringing up the reasons and the rationale for and against.
Sounds
so that was
good.
Just one session.
Yeah.
Another nice one was relating to the desktop was increasing the image size of the CD from 700 to 750 meg. Mm-hmm. So it won't actually fit on a CD.
Yeah, helpful.
Okay.
The idea behind that being, well, the original premise was let's go to 1.5 gig so it fits on a 2 gig stick.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's a cheap, like the lowest size stick, you know, roughly you could buy. But the problem with that is if you say you can go from 700 meg up to 1.5 gig, then potentially people get lazy and there's lots of slack and it bloats a bit.
Yeah.
And you end up putting stuff in there that you don't really need or want.
Or leaving stuff in there which you wanted at one point, but now it sort of doesn't matter either way.
Yeah. So Mark Shuttleworth came in and said, okay, I don't mind being the guy who says, let's make it 750 meg, which will make you disciplined, gives you more room, makes you disciplined, and potentially we can look at other ways in which you can bulk that image up. And there are other tools that we've got that will let you have like a base image and then extra packages on the USB stick if you wanted them.
Oh, I see, that you don't have to install.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of put a mini repository on the USB stick. That
That's
kind
quite
of thing.
Nice.
Yeah. But whether they will or not, and whether they will have a small version just for the CD, that's, again, going to pan out. So that was a cool one.
Okay.
There was more work on text-free and flicker-free boot up, because nobody likes it when you flick from one mode to another. You know, they get that jarring flicker.
Yes.
Whereas when you look at something like an Apple Mac, when you turn it on, you get a screen and then it just fades to the logon screen. There's no flickering around. There's no flashing cursor. There's no kernel messages flying up the screen. And people tend to like that. So there's going to be some work on that.
Okay.
Cool.
Sounds good.
Multi-monitor support. Lots of flack has been thrown at Unity because it doesn't really support lots of monitors.
Oh, okay.
And John Lee from the design team had a demo with six monitors, three on top, three on the bottom.
You got them on the plane?
No, this wasn't on. We wasn't doing the demo on the plane.
Oh.
But he had six monitors, and he was doing a demo showing how you might navigate around and how you might move your apps around on a big setup. That was quite cool. And there were some nice community sessions. Mm. There was one about how can we scale support. Mark blogged in the past about or mentioned at some point that he wants to go to 200 users. By
200 million users?
Sorry, how many did I say? 200 users.
200
users.
200.
Yeah, I think we've hit that.
Yeah.
Success.
There's four in this room. So.
200 million users by 2014, I think it was.
Right, okay.
I think. And that's quite a target or an aspiration. And so we were talking about, is it possible for us to scale the community up to help? You know,
Because
if we get that many people, you know, we've got to help them somehow.
Well, this is one of the things we were talking about during the leadership mini summit, was scaling some of our community infrastructure. I was able to participate remotely. I didn't get to go to America, but I was able to join in on IRC and listen into the streams, which was really interesting. And some groups of people were better at involving people listening in the streams than others.
Right.
The community crew were really quite good at getting people to join in and participate and listening to their responses and feeding them back into the conversation. Some of the others, it was a bit more hit and miss.
Sometimes you forget there's this IRC, because the IRC is projected onto a wall.
Right.
And sometimes you forget it's there and you forget people are talking to you and joining in remotely. That is a bit of a flaw.
I think sort of Alan Bell was kind of punching things through his keyboard trying to get some attention at one point. But yes, we were talking about how to scale the community and making sure that there are new people coming through who are going to be able to take over leadership positions in the community. Yeah. And some ideas about that, maybe making sure that people can't serve on too many committees at once, so that we don't become firstly over reliant on them, and secondly people just assume they're going to do the work because they're quite well known or whatever. So yeah, some interesting ideas there.
Yeah, those audio sessions, actually, they've all been recorded and archived. So you can,
cool.
We'll put a link in the show notes to where you can download them. So if there's any sessions you want to have a listen to and find out what was actually talked about, you can do. And there's one final one that I quite liked. Dustin Kirkland gave a talk about how he's improving Beobu, you know, the screen thing for terminals, by converting it from GNU screen to Tmux. And he gave a lovely demo, and I think it was videoed. And if it has been and it's on YouTube, then I'll put a link in.
What's the difference?
Tmux is just much more flexible. GNU screen is barely maintained. There's loads and loads of patches for it carried in Ubuntu.
I see.
And upstream haven't done a release in years.
Okay.
And Tmux is up to date and fast and good.
Cool.
And the demo was really cool. You should watch that.
Awesome.
But yes, have a look through the links that I'll put in the show notes and have a look at some of the sessions.
Yes, well, thank you for your UDS report.
Thank you. It's time for your feedback. And we've had a few emails about our ICT in schools segment in the last episode. Al Pagan, who's worked as a visiting media artist in schools and nurseries for the last 9 years, says he's been shocked at the lack of support for using computers in all aspects of education.
Computers are a part of almost every workplace, and yet the vast majority of classrooms do not provide laptops or desktops for each of the pupils to use. Part of the problem is the lack of teacher training, because without that, how can we expect them to implement them in the daily lesson plans? And then also network policies that block some of the largest free resources of information and free real-life examples of learning like YouTube, Twitter and Digg. I think the areas of ICT education that you discussed aren't valid, as it's not the teaching of the subject of ICT that needs to be addressed, but the inherent culture of segregating the use of computers within education as a whole.
That's a good point.
Mm. Yeah, we did have some other feedback that was along a similar line as well. And we didn't really have much time to talk about it during the show. But yes, there is ICT in a lot of other subjects as well.
Mm.
You look at it in geography and science and English and all that sort of stuff as well. Although we were really focusing on teaching computer science almost.
Yeah. Rather than ICT, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But yeah, interesting feedback. Thank you.
Andrew Higginson has completed his ITCT GCSE and is applying to do a degree that includes computer science at university. In his view,
one particular situation that stood out for me whilst doing ICT was a project where we had to create a website. The total mark for creating the website was 60, and out of these, 10 marks were awarded for the actual website. The other marks were for writing reports in what was essentially a hoop jumping exercise. These 10 marks were given irrespective of any advanced skill, such as using JavaScript or PHP, and students were not given exposure to HTML. It was all done through a WYSIWYG editor.
Oh dear.
That sounds like a very familiar experience to me.
Really?
Yeah, that's... I'm pretty sure that one of my sort of A-level computing project, the most of the marks were the report you wrote, not the system you made.
Yeah.
I think it'll be quite different if Andrew does go on to do a computer science degree.
Yes.
Where
yes.
I think it will be a lot more about what you actually build. Yeah, than,
definitely. At university level, it's definitely different.
Yes. So good luck with that, Andrew, and let us know how it goes.
Our camp fan Sam Bull emailed us just today with a couple of questions.
I think Alan mentioned something about getting EFI booting working on a new MacBook Air, single booting Ubuntu, and I was wondering if he knew a tutorial or something to achieve this. I was also wondering if anybody knew of a decent netbook that can run Ubuntu 11.10 for around £200. I want to buy one for my dad. The EPC X101 looks good, but there seems to be nowhere to buy it in the UK.
So the first question, yes, I run Ubuntu on my MacBook. It's not the model that he's got. And I understand there are some tricky things with MacBook Airs. There is a section of the Ubuntu wiki dedicated to MacBooks. And if you just do a search for wiki, Ubuntu and MacBook, you'll find a section there. It's broken down per model because there's lots of different models and they're all completely different and not documented very well. You will find some detail there. And there's also a team creating a PPA who have lots of extra packages for doing things like the keyboard light and the backlight brightness and all the other funky stuff that a Mac has in it. The second question, I don't know.
I would suggest laptopsdirect.co.uk who do reconditioned laptops. That's where I got mine from.
I would recommend not using them.
No? Why not?
Because they add you to an email list and spam you about all kinds of things that are nothing to do with laptops.
Oh, well, I still got a cheap EPC.
I'd go to someone like Amazon. But the problem is that... I don't know. I'm not sure I would buy a
netbook.
Other
retailers are available.
Yeah.
You wouldn't buy a netbook? What about just, yeah.
I'd buy a
tablet.
A laptop. I'd buy a laptop, not a netbook. Because the restriction of a netbook is small screen size. And I don't know, he's saying for his dad. I don't know how old his dad is, and I don't want to assume anything. Yeah. But, you know, netbooks have small screens, small keyboards. They're not ideal.
True. Maybe he just wants it carrying around.
Yeah. If you want something that's very portable, it is ideal.
Yeah, totally.
What about something like the Mini that we gave away?
Yeah, something like that.
A lot bigger screen, a lot bigger keyboard, still running an Atom type processor.
Yeah, same kind of spec as a netbook, but bigger screen, 10-inch screen.
Yeah, so that could work.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, excellent.
And Stephen Michael Kellett pointed us to the Ohio Locos podcast, Burning Circle, for their response to the discussion on ICT that we had in our last episode.
Yes, this is from Alpaca Herder, isn't it, on Twitter, as he is known.
Yes.
I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, unfortunately.
Yeah, so they basically played in our segment and then added a bit of commentary on the end about the local specific stuff in their state.
Oh, excellent.
That's quite cool.
Oh, it's a good job we release our stuff under Creative
Commons. Yes, marvellous.
Okay, well, excellent. Well, listen to that and you can find out. Probably they're telling us that we're wrong, I'd guess.
No.
Oh, they agree.
It's just a bit different over there, that's all.
Okay, well, that's cool. Interesting to have that sort of thing happen. I don't think it's happened before, has it?
No, it hasn't.
Okay, and here's something from the Wing Commander.
Wing Commander, Sir Arthur Curmudgeon here. Not now, Inga. I'm recording. But that's my Swedish masseuse, Inga. Lovely girl. Always hits the right spot. Since I'm now a bit of a famous silver surfer, I'm often asked what I think of the state of software design. I always reply with a story my father used to tell me. Not my real father, you understand. He went missing in the Andes 3 years before I was born. Anyway, the story concerns Operation Market Garden in the war. when we dropped soldiers behind the German lines at Arnhem in Holland. So this British paratrooper jumps out of the aeroplane and his fixed line rips clean off. No parachute. So he pulls the ripcord on his reserve chute and it comes off in his hand. Still no parachute. As he hurtles towards the flat landscape of the Low Countries, he says to himself, I bet the folding bicycle doesn't work either. So there you have it. Any similarity to Ubuntu Unity is probably just a coincidence. Over and out, the WC. Now then, Inga, have you warmed up the baby oil?
I have literally no idea what that was about.
I think it was a very clever parallel with something about Unity.
I'm not sure about the Swedish masseuse. It's getting a little bit of carry on.
Just a tiny bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's probably not a very clever point in there. But yeah, that's true, right? That's true, Laura. Probably a very clever point in there somewhere, but I'm too stupid to work out what it was.
That's the third time we've listened to it, though, to try and work it out.
Yeah.
He's too clever for us, that Wing Commander.
Yes.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thank you for listening. You can find out how to get in touch with us on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org, including voicemail numbers and Twitter feeds, Facebook, IRC channels, and all that lark. Let us know what you think about the show or give us your thoughts about Ubuntu and the community around it. Join us on Tuesday, the 22nd of November, for our next live episode.
Excellent. And who's going to be doing the quiz next time?
Whose turn is it? Have you done one?
Not this time, no.
I haven't either.
One of you.
One of you two.
I'll do it.
Yay! Being silent and looking at Laura managed to get me out of that.
Have to find the board.
Yes.
Oh, it's going to be Blockbusters again.
It is.
Excellent. Do we call it Blockbusters?
No, it's Ubuntu UK Busters.
Okay.
Podbusters.
Podbusters, there we go.
I don't know.
Okay. Right. Well, join us next time then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.